Otis Spann with Muddy Waters. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. And, of course, that might fit our conversation about to come up here about the Supreme Court decision. And we do that because Otis Spann passed away on this day in 1970. On our way to this conversation, I want to remind you of something coming up this Saturday that I would love you to have to join me. I'm hosting the World of the Play, Race and Representation, on Saturday, April the 26th at 5 p.m. It's a conversation that grows out of Everyman Theater's current production that's taking place. By the way, Meet Vera Stark, an incredible play. And you can join our next Word of the Play panel discussion. We're going to examine the effect of racial stereotypes within the entertainment world and its effect on our communities and greater culture. You can get more information at everymantheater.org or just show up and join us there on April 26th at 5 p.m. Get a ticket at the door at Everyman Theater, or go to everymantheater.org. You can check it out at steinershow.org. It's always an incredible discussion, and we'll be having that there this Saturday at 5 o'clock. Hope you can join it. And if you haven't seen this play, a Lynn Notage play, by the way, Meet Vera Stark, you're missing something incredible. We are now joined by Julianne Hing, reporter and blogger for Color Lines, and Horace Cooper, adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, co-chair of the Project 21 of the National Advisory Board, and a legal commentator, and Michael Higginbotham, who is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. His latest book is Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. And welcome all. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on today.
And
Thanks for having me.
It's great having you again, Julianne. Good to hear your voice.
Likewise.
And I am encouraging you all to join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner. We are going to rest with, I hope I say this right, the Schwete. Is that right? Schwete? Thank you. Thank you so much. All right, I was wrestling with that earlier. Schwete v. Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. This decision upheld Michigan's ban on race-conscious admission policies at state colleges, and didn't end affirmative action. It didn't say affirmative action was unconstitutional, but I think Schwete puts this thing to puts it down to a legal place where you can put it to a vote and end it. I think that could be the result of this. But let me start with you, because I know you only have a brief time with this, Julianne, to kind of wrestle with that first. What do you think this decision means?
Well, you know, so there are a few things to remember. This case, for people who care about affirmative action and universities' ability to consider race in their admissions policies, this ruling will not mean that much in the immediate. Practically, nothing really will change. The case concerned the not, as you said, Mark, whether or not universities can consider race in their admissions policies. It really concerned, and so bear with a little bit of lawyer speak, it concerned the constitutionality of states which are trying to pass affirmative action bans. And in this case, the Supreme Court found that, yes, states' voters can pass affirmative action bans. And because this concerned a state ballot initiative out of Michigan that was passed in 2006, you know, we're living in the year 2014, Michigan has adopted Proposal 2. And so in the immediate, it really will not mean much. But if we think about this in the long term, and if we think about the Roberts Court and the Supreme Court, and which has shown itself to be particularly hostile to affirmative action, it kind of helps to think of this as a chess game. The Supreme Court did not deal the death blow to affirmative action this time around. But what they're probably doing is, you know, they're three or four or five chess moves away from, you know, in this larger game of slowly dismantling affirmative action and race conscious policy. What has often been described is that affirmative action is dying the death of a thousand cuts, and so this is the era that we're living in.
I think you took the phrase out of my mind, the dying a death of a thousand cuts, because that is what we're seeing in the Supreme Court on a number of levels here. But let me turn, before I turn to Mike Linkenbotham for his analysis overall and get into more specifics. Horace, welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
Your analysis.
So I look at this and I say that the inevitable march toward a colorblind effort on the part of governments to not be race conscious in terms of handing out contracts or admissions or hiring or anything else got another level of support this time from the Supreme Court. But here's the truth. There has been a discussion underway in America about the efficacy of how much of what's done in the name of affirmative action has succeeded or not succeeded. What's important here about this case, most of all, is that this is not going to be an issue snatched away from the people. This is going to be an issue that remains with the people. The court made it clear that they saw no reason for the courts themselves to somehow try to referee these things. That means city councils, that means state governments, that means the federal governments, political branches are going to be able to have free rein to continue in this dialogue and conversation. My view, if those supporters of affirmative action want to maintain its presence, they're going to have to engage on the political side of the table and set aside all of the time and energy that they've been putting in having the courts rescue this program.
Well, I'm going to come back to some of that. You said a lot, all of you, as did Julianne and Michael. Your perspective on this means overview.
Well, I generally agree with the comments by both of the previous commentators. I think it's good news and bad news. The good news is affirmative action is still constitutionally permissible. The bad news is there's another limitation that has been imposed in this 20 to 30 year Supreme Court discussion about the constitutionality of affirmative action. I think the real problem here and the two flaws that I see in the decision is one, the characterization of affirmative action as some sort of preferential treatment as opposed to a justifiable remedy. And the second problem, and even I think a bigger problem, is to leave this question open to the electoral process. In other words, to allow a popularity contest as to whether or not affirmative action is going to continue or not. And I think many states like Michigan and California and others, if you leave it to a popularity vote, you may prohibit affirmative action, which provides then for an inadequate remedy for creating equal opportunity in our society today.
So I think this is kind of the heart of the question. You could see it in the kind of vote that took place, which I want to talk a bit about over the top of the hour. But Julianne, I think that this does go. I'm curious your thoughts on what Horace said and what Michael just said about what could be shifting in America. And I just don't mean the questions of how the Supreme Court has dealt with issues of race and voting rights and corporate constitutionality questions when it comes to voting and other issues, electoral policy issues. But that it seems that one of the things happening with this court is that what has been the battleground of lawyers for the last 60 years, 70 years, may become a vicious political ground and fight on the ground. How do you see that happening?
Yeah, it's a very, very big question to tackle. But these are some important things to keep in mind. We are living in an era of deep hostility towards not just affirmative action, but any kind of remedy or any kind of policy which seeks to explicitly acknowledge the ways that racism. We are living with the legacies of racism and, frankly, the ongoing impacts of living in a deeply, you know, racially inequitable society. And so this has been, I think that for people who care about affirmative action, it, in my rather bleak view, you know, the rhetorically in the court of public opinion, affirmative action really, really has lost. Actually,
has lost. So, is that what you said?
I would say, yeah. I mean, the hostility to affirmative action, the amount of fear-mongering, the rhetoric that is spread about affirmative action has really gripped the country. And so what we are seeing is a multi-pronged attack to dismantle affirmative action via first the courts, which has been successful. Schutte v. Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action is just the second case in the last 2 years that the Supreme Court has handled that concerns affirmative action. We're seeing state ballot initiatives that are trying to ban affirmative action at the state level. We're seeing plaintiffs challenging individual universities' right to consider admissions, and so it's a really multi-pronged attack that the Supreme Court is very game to step into at this current Supreme Court and really dismantle. I mean, we did see this not just with affirmative action. We saw it with Shelby v. Holder and voting rights, where the Supreme Court last year gutted voting rights and the Voting Rights Act. And so what we're seeing is a real inability on the part of this Supreme Court to understand the way that race and racism operates in this country. We're seeing the Supreme Court, the majority of the Supreme Court, there are some very, very vocal dissenters, but they're in the minority, but the majority of the Supreme Court really sees race and racism as something that in order for it to be considered racism or discrimination, it must be intentional. It must be invidious. There's really this understanding that unless racism is someone standing at the schoolhouse doors barring black children from entering schools, that it's not racism. And in fact, today inequity manifests itself in lots of different ways. And we're living in an age where racism is much more structural, much more subtle, much more systemic. And the Supreme Court has shown that it's really unable to wrap its mind around all the different ways that racism manifests itself.
Well, Julianne, I let you go on because I know you have to leave, and I want to let you get it all out before you had to go. I wish you could stay for the political part of the discussion because your voice is important, but I know you have to run, so we'll talk to you very soon again.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Good to have you with us. Julianne Hing is reporter and blogger for Color Lines. We're going to remain here with Horace Cooper and Michael Higginbotham to tackle the issues that happened on the Supreme Court. And I have some very specific legal questions looking at how the court's made up and where it's going, but tackle the political questions of what might come next with our two guests and you at 410-319-8888. Kareem, you are the first caller up, and we are going to take your call after you get back from this break and hear a bit from our two guests. So stay on, Kareem. We're going to come to you and the other callers in the rest of this program. We have another good 40 minutes to go in this discussion. Stay with us.
A song of you. Comes as sweet and clear. Leaves of green. Red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue.
Louis Armstrong, 1968. Hit number one in Great Britain here with What a Wonderful World. At 69 years old, he became the oldest person to score number one in Britain. And before that, for that, we heard Ray Charles, whose songs Georgia became the state song of Georgia on this day in 1979. Georgia on my mind, I should say. And I guess the question would be, is if this is now going to be where black human rights comes to America, where it's just state songs, not human rights. And we're going to talk about that with our two guests who will remain here with us for this conversation right now. And so let's get back to this at 410-319-8888. Good to have you all here with us as we talk with our two guests. So let me, Horace Cooper and Michael Higginbotham. So I'd like to kind of pick up where we left off, and Horace, I'll let you go first and go to Michael,
sure.
And I want to have very specific kind of legal questions here coming up and about what you thought about these opinions and also the role of Sotomayor on this court. But this is becoming, this is a thing I think in some ways throwing this into the political battles of community and politics in America, and we're not sure where that goes given the present landscape. Horace?
So here's the problem with the last statements that were made about the court and its, quote, lack of sensitivity and the difficulty of understanding that racism today may not be open and notorious the way that it once was. It has migrated. It's more impactful in its ways that are harder to tell. The problem with all of that analysis is, even if I concede it's all true, it fails to address that the law didn't change so as to cover this kind of behavior. There is a difference between tax avoidance and tax cheating. One of them you can be punished for. The other you cannot be, even if the end result is you get to keep more of your income in both. In the case of this so-called more subtle, more institutionally operated bigotry or discrimination, the courts are required to actually apply existing law. And the law has never, as far back as Bakke, the law has never said there's no case showing where you could say, because of all of the years of past injustice that have happened in America, we are now ordering X outcome to occur. That has never been found in any particular court ruling. To now expect that is to fail to understand how law operates.
Michael Higginbotham.
Well, I think it's actually a very interesting point. The debate between the justices has gone on for 20, 25 years, and most of these decisions in the affirmative action arena have been 5-4 decisions. What the previous commentator indicated was that a majority of 5 have required intentional racial discrimination to establish a violation of equal protection. 4 dissenters, including, of course, Justice Marshall, said this is the wrong standard. We need to be more concerned about impact, negative impact, disproportionate impact on racial minorities, rather than looking at the intent of the discriminator and whether there is invidious action or not. And so, to me, this debate continues. And Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, pointed out that we need to not only understand the history, the racial oppression that occurred in the society, but we also need to understand the current reality of what continues to go on. And so we haven't, under our current law, as the previous commentator mentioned, we haven't been able to prevent some of the disproportionate harm to racial minorities that occurs because actions are more subtle today. We no longer have Jim Crow laws requiring separate and unequal treatment, but we do have various actions such as racial profiling, such as underfunding of schools. We have actions that are not overtly racist on their face, but have a tremendous disproportionate impact, like voter ID laws. And so what's going on today is very different in terms of overtness than what went on in the past under Jim Crow. Nonetheless, the result is the same. And so Justice Stevens, when he talked about in the affirmative action case from 20 years ago, when Justice Stevens said, we need to be more concerned about impact. When I see a disproportionate impact of 4 or 5-1, I'm less concerned about the intent of the discriminator. I'm more concerned about the harmful impact to the victims. And so I think we need to change the law. And that's something that I argue in my book, Ghosts of Jim Crow. We need to change the intent standard to an effect standard. And this is what we have done in the employment arena in terms of congressional statutory law. If you look at the, you know, 64 Civil Rights Act that talks about employment discrimination, that has been interpreted by the Supreme Court as preventing not only intentional discrimination, but discrimination that results in a disproportionate impact. So we shift the burden. That's what we need to do in other arenas, such as education.
So I'm going to pick up on the points you just made here and go back to some of the points that were made before and try to get to at least a paragraph from these opinions, because I was really taken by what Justice Sotomayor said in the length of her opinion, also by, as you pointed out just now, Michael Higginbotham, the breadth of the decision in terms of the vote and what that vote meant, the numbers in that vote. So, but let me go to the phones first. We'll come right back to that with our two guests, Michael Higginbotham and Horace Cooper. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Kareem, you're on the air. Kareem, you want to turn down your radio? You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Kareem.
Mark, I care about affirmative action, and I think that our attorneys and our politicians have to have a paradigm shift. And what I mean by that is, when affirmative action was voted in, it was an agreement made between the United States and other countries in the United Nations. Any person from any country that goes to another country has affirmative action rights based on that person being a minority in that country. So everybody in the country can get affirmative action if they're a minority here. So the shift should be to one of nationality instead of racism. That's why, because they're not going to get rid of affirmative action laws and rights based on that agreement that they made in the United Nations. But the discussion of racism for us as African Americans or blacks or whatever we want to call ourselves now, we need to declare something of our nationality and claim our rights, because that's why they're playing around with the law. They're not getting rid of the law, because the law is an international agreement.
Okay. Kareem, I think what you're raising here is actually an interesting issue. We've tackled it some time back in the Mark Steiner Show about how international law has affected race in this country and around the world. In our legal decisions, it might come to the future. I think we need to take what you're saying and wrestle with that in a larger arena here, because I think it is an interesting question. Michael, do you have any thoughts on this?
Sure. I think it's an interesting way to look at affirmative action debate is, as the caller has done, to look at it as a remedy, as a solution to the history of race discrimination and inequality in the country. And I think if we look at it that way, I mean, certainly other countries have adopted affirmative action policies, such as South Africa, countries with a similar history of discrimination. And I think if you look at affirmative action in that respect, as part of the solution, as what we as a country say we want to get to, a post-racial America, a place where all have equal opportunity irrespective of race. So if you look at affirmative action in that respect as part of the solution, as part of supplying an adequate remedy for the history of race discrimination and oppression that occurs, I think affirmative action makes a lot more sense and is not looked at as a preference but a justifiable implementation of an activity.
Now, one of the things I'm going to read to you both, and then we go back to the phones, and Mike, you're the next caller up, is that Justice Kennedy wrote with Roberts and Alito that one of those premises is that a democracy has the capacity and the duty to learn from its past mistakes, to discover and confront persisting biases, and by respectful, rational deliberation to rise above those flaws and injustices. It is demeaning to the democratic process to presume that voters are not capable of deciding an issue of this sensitivity on decent and rational grounds. And Justice Breyer wrote an opinion supporting the majority, but in a different view. Justice Sotomayor wrote, I think, is what's being called one of the longest responses in the history of the Supreme Court. Really intense. I tried to read as much of it as I could. There's a lot there, and I'm not a lawyer. But she did write, "We are fortunate to live in a democratic society, but without checks, democratically approved legislation can oppress minority groups. For that reason, our Constitution places limits on what a majority of the people may do. This case implicates one such limit, the guarantee of equal protection of laws. The Constitution does not protect racial minorities from political defeat, but neither does it give the majority free rein to erect selective barriers against racial minorities. The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination as members of the judiciary tasked with intervening to carry out the guarantee of equal protection. We ought not sit back and wish away rather than confront the racial inequality that exists in our society in this view that works harm by perpetuating the facile notion that what makes race matter is acknowledging the simple truth that race does matter." So in some ways, I think she was – this is what I think some of what that was being said earlier by Julianne Hing is kind of – is Justice Sotomayor kind of questioning the complexities of where race is in America now. And I wonder if one of the things you were saying, Horace, and then I'll go back to Michael and then go back to the phones – is it that the fact that American law, based in what it's based in the history of this Constitution, is not adequately equipped to deal with the depth of racism in this country?
No, I didn't say that.
No, I know you didn't. I didn't say you said it. I said it.
I said there's a difference between tax cheating and tax avoidance.
Right, I understand
now,
that.
There's a reason Justice Sotomayor's passionate dissent didn't get Justice Breyer to join in. The simplistic answer is, well, she's a minority and he's not. The more likely analysis is, there has never, ever been a holding by the court that, in fact, this past mandates and empowers the Supreme Court to require all the remedies that affirmative action encompasses. I have a very, very simple question. If this mechanism had been struck down as unconstitutional, saying that you can't actually act this way, and a new governor came in, and that governor fired all of the members or asked the legislature to impeach all of the members who run the governing boards of the colleges and made them now go on the new ones and require a race-neutral admissions policy, would Justice Sotomayor say, and no, you can't do that either? Where does the right of the community to have a say over the tax dollars that it requires itself to spend, where does that begin and where does that end? Even Justice Breyer acknowledged that without a specific showing of some kind of discrimination, which is what the law presently requires, you can't get this remedy.
Michael?
Well, the first thing is I think we need to redefine prohibited discrimination, and that will, I think, correct the problem and make Justice Sotomayor's position one that will help to reduce racial discrimination and racial disparities in our country today. The second aspect, and I think it's just really, you know, important to look at as a practical matter. I'm all for democracy. I'm all for the will of the people. I'm all for the community to have input. But there are certain things that the Constitution guarantees. One of them that the 14th Amendment created was equal protection of the laws. And we need to understand, of course, what that means. So some things are not left to the will of the people. We wouldn't have left the decision of slavery to the will of the people.
We wouldn't have left
the decision of Jim Crow to the will of the people. And so I think we want to be very careful that we don't leave providing an adequate remedy for the history of race discrimination and the current inequities that continue to the will of the people.
Okay, I got to challenge this. That's total lawlessness. The reason that we got slavery in the Constitution was an undemocratic process. A majority on the Supreme Court declared it so, notwithstanding lots of powerful arguments that they had no authority to do this. The very problem of this approach, and the reason, even when Justice Marshall was sitting on the Supreme Court, there has never been a case where the court said, hey, Richmond, hey, Detroit, you are required, you must engage in affirmative action measures as a way to remedy injustice in the past. There has always been a requirement. You identify a violation, you assess what the appropriate remedy is, and you implement it. At no point, even Justice Marshall has ever said that it's required. The reason that this view does not succeed is if you take it away from the people, you imply that the Constitution actually requires this outcome, and you can scour 200 plus years of Supreme Court precedent, and you can't even find a dissent making that case.
Is this for the interest of time? Michael, let me let you back in, because I do want to get back to the phones here. But Michael?
Sure. I think that if you look at Justice Marshall's position and four justices in dissent, they basically would disagree with what the commentator just said. They had a big debate with the Supreme Court justices at the time. And if you look at what Justice Marshall and Justice Brennan said in dissent, they would, in fact, find affirmative action quite justifiable in terms of responding to general societal discrimination. That was Marshall's position. It was a dissenting position, but it was there were four justices who agreed. So the commentator is talking about a majority of five, but when he characterizes Justice Marshall and the four in dissent as agreeing with that position, I think that's a mistake.
410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air. Hi, Mike Scott, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, you know, these are really interesting sort of legal arguments and debates, but I think we have to also keep in mind the original affirmative action, which was 400 years of codified white supremacy, and including by the law, right? So we're talking about the Pocahontas Law, we're talking about the Ozawa case and the Sin case, and all of the eugenics, you know, the faux science of eugenics that was adopted by all the major institutions of policy, not just law, of the United States, that codified, you know, from Manifest Destiny on to our foreign policy, you know, injustices that can actually be measured, right? And so, you know, I don't suffer fools, even though I suffer foolishness with love, you know, but you can't allow folks to get conveniently dumb around these very real things that we can that look over the history course of time, look at the impact and measure, and realize that there was an original sin and an original affirmative action that has never been redressed. And I believe that, you know, in addition to these fine legal scholars' points, one of the things that the people must do with some fine legal scholarship help, like Marshall did, is to begin to bring cases to educate the judiciary, knowing we're going to lose, but that we will, you know, continue to educate the judiciary about disparate impacts. And, you know, that's the basis of our work at Equity Matters and Place Matters around showing health disparities that, you know, that had an original sin going back to redlining. I mean, that, you know, showing institutional racism is still manifest over years, and showing those kind of outcomes is what's necessary in conjunction with the strategy that educates the judiciary, you know, even knowing you're going to lose some of the cases. But you know, it's a long process.
Okay. I want to focus back on Justice Marshall. You can look at Justice Marshall when he was counsel for the NAACP, when he served as Solicitor General, when he was sitting on the United States Supreme Court. There is not one example where a petitioner came and said, because of the 400 years of injustice, I ask you to issue this court order giving me X remedy because the Constitution requires it. You can't find that case. There have always been questions about whether a specific practice of affirmative action is lawful. That has been the conversation. There is no evidence and no issue, and this is why Justice Sotomayor's case couldn't even get Justice Breyer to join us.
So, Michael, let me let you respond to that, but I want to come back to what the other Mike said in this thing. Go ahead.
I don't think we're going to agree on this. Justice Marshall indicated it's permissible. May not be required, but it's permissible, and that's what the debate is today. You know, whether or not the electoral process can prohibit this or whether or not it should be permissible. So maybe there's some agreement there between me and Sam, but I think we should maybe leave it and move on to maybe some other things that the caller had mentioned.
And I do want to do that. I think that because I want to take a break. We have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want to get to that because I think there's a huge question here, and I think that what this lays open is this question that you raised earlier, Michael Lickenbotham, about the difference between intent and effect as a standard of law. But that also raises some deeper political and philosophical questions about where America's been and where it's going. And, you know, Mike Scott talks about educating judiciary, but I think that which I don't think is probably wrong, but I think on the other hand, this is a deeper political and philosophical struggle in America taking place. And I'm wondering now if in some ways this battle is, given the nature of the court and the length of time that justices remain on the court and how they get appointed, this struggle over this issue becomes more political than legal in the coming years.
Well, I think it's been very politicized. I mean, if you look at what President Reagan did in 1980 when he came in, he really politicized the judiciary by making a litmus test for his federal appointees. And one dealt with abortion tests, but the other one dealt with affirmative action. And so the people that President Reagan put on the bench basically were individuals who were opposed to affirmative action. And so it's been politicized really since then. If you look at the Republican Party and the Democratic Party prior to that, there was pretty much agreement on supporting affirmative action. Even President Nixon had been a big supporter of federal affirmative action hiring. I think it got politicized in the 80s, and it continues to be very, very politicized today with respect to judicial appointments as well as debate on the court.
Well, I have a question for Horace when we come back from this break. So we're going to take a very quick break and come back to conclude our conversation with our two guests here at the moment, Michael Higginbotham and Horace Cooper. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll come to the calls as well as much as we can. We're going to go out with Otis Spann. I've got Ramblin' on My Mind, reminding on the way to break, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner. We'll be right back.
But you treat me so unkind. The blues, how was it? Don't lack nobody. You know the blues, don't lack nobody. But you can buy the blues, baby, only for a dollar or quarter.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Otis Spann, died on this day in 1970. Blues don't like nobody. I love Otis Spann. I'm sorry I passed away. I was got a chance to play some of his music between breaks here. We are here with Michael Higginbotham Wilson, Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Horace Cooper is an adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, co-chair of the Project 21 National Advisory Board. And you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So let me just ask this question. This may be a little out of purview exactly of this case, but I don't think it is because we've been talking about what this case may – how it may change the nature of how America addresses issues of race, racism, and discrimination from here on in. But let me just ask you this one question first, if I might, Horace, and then go to Michael. I mean, when we were talking about intent versus effect and other issues like that, I mean, do you say that that institutional racism, that racism on the part of governments and people who manage institutions, in even unconscious racism, university level, wherever that is, does not exist in America? And if you think it does exist, then what's your remedy for it?
Okay, so if I fall asleep and accidentally land on you and injure you, I'm immune from you getting recovery because my actions weren't intentional. That's part of the reason why our system of law has never incorporated this nexus or chimera called institutional racism. We've always required that if there is a violation, that there be an identified violator and that a remedy be tied directly to the violator's actions, however big or however small. This idea of this institutional racism approach has not been incorporated into the law, and a lot of people, and that's why I enjoy coming on your program, a lot of people who don't know their history think that it is, and that somehow today or this week we made some sharp divergent turn. We haven't. If you want that to be part of the law, that's a conversation that you actually need to have, that our president, when he ran for office twice, maybe might have been relevant for him to bring up and say, elect me, and this is one of the changes I will undertake.
And didn't. Michael Higginbotham.
Yeah, I would just respond by saying that it's not a part of the constitutional law, but it has been a big part of statutory law, as I mentioned with the employment discrimination laws in the 64 Civil Rights Act, but also it's been a part of other legislative initiatives. When you look at programs trying to assist people to have a better opportunity, whether they be economic programs or educational programs. So while it may not be a part of constitutional interpretation with respect to five justices on the Supreme Court, it has been a large part of our discussion in terms of statutory law and other programs designed to help people.
So where does it go from here then? Mike, let me start with you and go back to Horace. I mean, that's the question I'm trying to probe here is whether we're at a stage, given the makeup of the court, if one maintains that institutional racism is deep in this country and exists, and that it is something that is not, as you pointed out earlier, not kind of something tangible like literally fighting slavery or segregation, something you can physically see and physically see the results of, then how does that change the nature of what has to happen? This Supreme Court we have now, the chances are that if you wanted to see President Barack Obama appoint a new Supreme Court justice, that, as we alluded to there in our private conversation, that may not happen. So where does this leave those people who believe, as you do, about what the law should be?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and there are various ways to secure additional rights in the country. That is part of our democratic process. So the court is one of those ways. But if the court doesn't change, and as this case indicates, the court has basically thrown the permissibility of affirmative action back to the states and to popular sovereignty aspects. And so that's where the battle needs to occur. People who feel strongly in support of affirmative action need to go to their state legislators. They need to go to their state Supreme Court justices, and they need to peacefully protest, go to various foundations like the NAACP and the ACLU that have been very supportive of affirmative action programs, and ask for continued movement through the democratic process dealing with the state legislatures.
Horace?
I don't disagree with that analysis. What I would say is, and when people show up, they should expect that they're going to have to answer hard questions. Part of the reason that there's so much angst over this upcoming ruling, which I could have forecast 25 years ago, is people don't understand the history, they don't understand the law, and they only have been talking with people who think exactly the way they do. They're going to have to answer the question, how do you shift from a system that requires a specific individual or corporation or entity being held responsible to a collective or even a societal responsibility? Even the disparate impact rules that the courts have allowed always say we shift the presumption because we believe it's likely there was actually an individual who was engaging in behavior, and we are asking that individual to give us show cause. In these visits and encounters and political activity, people are going to be required to answer the question, how long should this go? How do you measure success? Who should the parties be that are impacted? Who ought to be exempted? These are the very kinds of questions that Justice Kennedy in his ruling said was the natural process for issues like this.
Michael?
Well, I think I would agree with Horace, and I think it's very important that folks do ask the questions and answer the questions. And I think that we need to shift the burden, as he indicated, not only in the employment laws, but in many of the other laws. Because the reality today is that the burden is more than half of the ball game. And that's really been the problem with the intent standard, that the burden is too high of a burden, high of a threshold for plaintiffs to meet and prove discrimination that goes on today. So I agree, if we can shift the burden to those who are, in fact, accused of discriminating to prove that they are not, I think that would be a huge benefit to our society in terms of reducing the presence of race discrimination today.
But given the state, then there's one last thought here, then we have to take a break here and go to our next guest. Given the state of this country and given the state of race in America and intertwined with politics, if this is all put to the vagaries of our political world and our political spectrum, then what can one can really expect? You might be able to expect one thing in New York City, but a very different thing in Alabama. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, this to me portends a lot of issues and problems for the future. A very quick thought from both of you, starting with Horace and then Michael, in the next few minutes, 2 minutes we have.
Okay, so in a federalist system, what works and makes sense in Florida doesn't necessarily work and make sense in Connecticut. And we accept that and we're thrilled by it. The idea that the injustices that black Americans faced were overcome simply by resorting or running to the courts is mythology. The 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, these were all the political vagaries, as you described them, that allowed people to come together, they listened to good arguments, and they were persuaded. If you want additional change, that's what you're going to have to do. But if you don't go through the courtesy of that discussion and simply have people talk among themselves, it's easy. Oh, they're racist. That's why they disagree with me. Oh, they're bigots. They hate women. That's an easy, simple, a simplistic tool to operate. It won't make much change. Now, my hope is when people enter into the conversation and they get asked hard questions, they reconsider the expectations that they had, and they get persuaded just as likely as they are able to persuade others.
Michael, my guess is you're not a believer in the federal system that way. Go ahead.
It's a real problem. I think, you know, it highlights going back to, you know, problems we had with states' rights. I mean, it highlights the real problem because I think in some states you're going to have affirmative action voted in, and I think in other states you're going to have it voted out. This is a national problem. The race disparities that exist today are national, and that's the problem when you see the Voting Rights Act being struck down. I mean, we need to have an expanded Voting Rights Act nationally that covers not only the Confederate states, but it covers everyone, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and places in the North. So this is the problem that's being highlighted, and I think you're going to have some states saying affirmative action is permissible, other states saying it's not. And that's really unacceptable today in our society, where equality should be across the board in all 50 states.
Michael Higginbotham, Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law, the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Horace Cooper is the adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research. Thank you both so much for being with us. It's been a great conversation, and I look forward to having you both back very soon.
Thank you so much for coming on today.
And good luck when you debate today at noon, Michael.
Thanks a lot. Debating Jennifer Gratz from the affirmative action case, Gratz versus University of Michigan.
Take care. We'll take a very break. And folks, go there if you can. We're going to take a very short break and come back. We'll talk with Carlo Woody, founder of Kenosis Spirit Keepers. Stay with us.
Seems like everywhere I go, people try to do me wrong. If I mistreat you people,